I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David K. Johnston has appeared on our program many times talking about the income gap between the very wealthy and just about everybody else in this country. Today, the conversation is about Donald Trump and David's new book, The Making of Donald Trump. David has been an investigative reporter since he was 18 years old. He's reported for the San Jose Mercury, Detroit Free Press, LA Times, Philadelphia Inquirer, the New York Times. He has won a Pulitzer Prize for exposing tax dodges and loopholes. He's received all kinds of awards and is author of other books, including Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch. He is a columnist for The Daily Beast, National Memo, and USA Today, and also teaches at Syracuse University College of Law. He says in 1987, he became interested in casinos after the Supreme Court ruled that Native Americans had a right to own them. He was concerned it would all lead to the spread of casinos across the country, run mostly by corporate America. So he applied for a job. Philadelphia Inquirer was interested, and in June of 1988, he moved to Atlantic City. A few days later, he met Donald Trump, and he has followed his career very carefully for the past 30 years and has interviewed Donald Trump many times. There's an awful lot to cover in this book. It is a fuller story about Trump than, he says, the one that Trump has polished and promoted with such exceptional skill and determination. David, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me on again, Kathleen.
Thanks, David. I'm glad the book's getting attention. Has he said he's going to sue you yet?
Oh, yes. He called me April 27th at my home, and it was a standard Donald Trump call, you know, hail fellow well met, looking for some information which he already had, not interested in discussing anything of substance. Romance, you know, I like a lot of the things you've written over the years. They've been terrific. Menace. If you write, if I don't like what you write, I'm going to sue you. Well, Donald, you're a public figure, which he knows means I would have, he would have to show I knowingly, deliberately lied. Mm. And he said, yeah, I know I'm a public figure, but I'll sue you anyway. Click.
Mm. And that intimidates some.
That's just who he is.
And it does intimidate some people in the news business, you've said. That's intimidating.
Oh, yes. And, you know, in the almost 50 years I've been doing this, the most heavily lawyered article of my life, and I've hunted somebody down who committed a murder and accused him of murder. I've gotten the worldwide head of Ernst & Young fired. Jack Welch gave up his retirement perks. I've exposed foreign agents and domestic spies. That was the most heavily lawyered article of my life. It was a piece for Politico magazine about Donald's connections to swindlers, con artists, a drug trafficker, mafioso, Russian mobsters. Even though there wasn't any news in it, I was just simply bringing it all together to make sense.
Mm. Let's start with, there's so much in the book. There are stories, the ones that particularly get me is when, you know, you're really preying on the underdog. The Trump University story is troublesome. The how he treated his nephew who had cerebral palsy, who was really cut out of the father's, his father's will, and what Trump, how was it he was involved in that. And this whole deal of building the Trump Tower with these Polish workers who were paid virtually nothing. Which one do you want to start with?
Oh, your pick.
All right, let's start with the nephew, because I never read a complete account of this until I read it in your book. I read something in another paper, but it indicated that, oh, it was settled and Trump handled the nephew nicely. You would indicate that he really fought to not have those children included in the will.
So Fred Trump's father died 17 years ago, and at his funeral, one of the people who spoke was Freddie Trump III. That is, Fred Trump had a son named Fred Trump Jr., and it was his son. And his pregnant wife, Lisa, was sitting there, and a couple days later, she delivered a baby who turned out to have hellacious medical problems, nearly died, stopped breathing. The Trump Organization provides really good medical care to all of its employees. One of the things Donald absolutely believes in is we should all have very good medical care. When the will was read from the patriarch, it turned out that instead of being split five ways, the son who died, Fred Jr.'s line, was cut out of the will. They got minimal money. I know you'll be surprised, Kathleen, to hear that that line of the family went to court saying, we think there was
going
on here.
Right.
And, in fact, Fred Trump's lawyer had warned that this would probably happen. And immediately, Donald cut off the health care for the family. Mm. Now, the family went and got a court order to stop that, at least temporarily, while it was sorted out. And Donald was asked about this at the time, and he said, well, I don't like people to sue my father. I mean, what am I supposed to do? And he was asked, well, don't you think it'll look cold-hearted? You're putting the life of an infant in jeopardy. And Donald's answer was, well, what else am I supposed to do? And it's indicative of who Donald is. Donald has no empathy for any other person. This is a man who, when he decided to leave his first wife and take up and briefly marry his mistress of many years, Marla Maples, went out and publicly humiliated his wife in every way that he could, to the point where, until they were grown-ups and went to work for Dad, started enjoying a very nice economic life, his children were totally estranged from him. You know, Donald is a guy who, you exist for one of two purposes, Kathleen. Either you understand Donald is the greatest person around and you worship him and you think he's the greatest person there is. And if you don't, well, he has a word for you. Loser.
Hmm. Yeah, he uses that word a lot. I am reading the book about Bobby Kennedy simultaneously with yours, and it was interesting that the name Roy Cohn came up. I was not aware that that was the first guy he started doing business with, the guy who worked with Senator Joseph McCarthy, and thought of him as a father figure.
Yes. As soon as Donald got out of college, and he wanted to be part of the Manhattan crowd, not the Queens where his father was from, so he got a little apartment. He made a beeline to meet Roy Cohn. And he said later Roy Cohn was like a second father. He was a mentor, and he said he admired that Roy was under indictment but was never convicted of anything for most of his adult life. And he also said the great thing about Roy is he would brutalize for you. And Roy Cohn represented mobsters, which turned out to be very beneficial to Donald, made him a lot of money. When Donald built Trump Tower, which is a 58-story concrete structure, it's not a steel girder building, there was a cement strike in New York. And every project in New York using cement was shut down except Trump Tower, because Roy Cohn's clients included Fat Tony Salerno, the head of the Gambino family, and Paul Castellano, the head of the Genovese's, and they owned S&A Concrete, and it was S&A Concrete's ready mix that was used to build Trump Tower.
And do you think that Trump was aware of that?
Of course he was. He'll deny that and say, I had no idea, because that's what Donald does. But of course he was aware of that. How would he not be aware? And by the way, other major families in New York in development, the Samuel Lefrak, the Resnicks, they were going to the FBI and saying, please, will you rid us of these mafia guys who are jacking up prices and control the unions? And Rudy Giuliani and his team went in and they successfully did that. In one of the charges, the racketeering charges, involved cement that Donald Trump bought that was inflated in its price. And when that case was over, Michael Chertoff, the federal prosecutor, said that the government had now shut down the most vicious organized crime operation in the history of America. And you think about things like what went on in Chicago in the 20s, the most vicious.
Mm. You also write about, you say, among the assorted criminals with whom he did business over more than three decades, his most mysterious dealing involved a drug trafficker named Joseph, I don't know how to pronounce his last name,
Wexelbaum.
Wexelbaum. Who was he? A three-time felon. He did unusual favors for him.
Joe Wexelbaum was a major drug trafficker who ran an operation from Miami to Cincinnati, Ohio, and who personally handled the drugs in shipments of up to 1,500 pounds. He also supplied Donald Trump's helicopters for his high rollers to go to Atlantic City, for his executives to go back and forth between Atlantic City and New York, and he managed Donald Trump's personal helicopter at the time called the Ivana. And when he was indicted in Cincinnati in 1985, Donald, as a casino owner, should have cut off all relationships with him. As a casino owner, you were required by law to prove by clear and convincing evidence that you were of good moral character, that you were honest, that you could pay your bills, and that you did not associate with criminals. Instead, some very strange things happened, Kathleen. First of all, Wexelbaum agreed to plead guilty, and his case was transferred to New Jersey, where nothing in the case had anything to do with New Jersey. And it came before Judge Marianne Trump Berry, Donald's older sister.
His sister, yeah.
I mean, this is just, and nobody can explain how this happened. Now, she did the legally required thing. She went to the chief judge, and she said, I have to recuse myself. I can't be in this case because I fly in this man's helicopters. My husband, who's a lawyer for Donald, he flies in the helicopters. Our children fly in these helicopters. But if you're the chief judge, the message you just got is, this is a really sensitive case. I got a federal judge here who's flying in helicopters owned by a confessed drug trafficker.
Yeah.
Well, the little fish in this, the people who actually, you know, drove the drugs around, they got up to 20 years. Donald wrote a letter pleading for mercy for this guy. And remember, he was cut off health care for this sickly, helpless infant.
Mm-hmm.
But he wrote a letter seeking mercy for this drug trafficker and saying he's a stand-up guy. He got 18 months, not 20 years, and when he got out, he moved into a multimillion dollar apartment in Trump Tower.
Ooh. And who's the other guy? You talk about the story of his wife, Donald and his wife, going to Denver, I believe, with Sater, or it's spelled a couple different ways, S-A-T-E-R or S-A-T-T-E-R, depending on what you're trying to cover up.
So Felix Sater, S-A-T-E-R, S-A-T-T-E-R, is the son of the reputed boss of the Russian mob in New York City. He's been involved in numerous criminal activities. As when he was in his mid-20s, he got into a bar fight and he took the broken end of a margarita glass and put it so deeply into a guy's face he'll never recover, and it took 110 stitches.
Ew.
In 1998, he confessed to running a $40 million stock swindle that involved four of the New York mafia families, the Colombos, the Gambinos, the Genoveses, and the Bananos. He's also been apparently an asset of the Central Intelligence Agency. Loretta Lynch, when she was the U.S. prosecutor in Brooklyn, said that he was a big help in national security matters, and apparently this involved intercepting missiles on their way to terrorists. Now, I point out to you that if you have a vice cop in a city who is making a big name shutting down, say, whorehouses, there's a good chance that his girlfriend is running competing whorehouses. And if you're able to intercept and stop the flow of missiles, you do have to wonder, well, how would you have the connections to know about this? What business might you or your friends be in? In any event, Donald traveled all over the country with this guy. There's photographs and video of him together with him in Colorado, Arizona, Florida, and New York. And there are lawsuits galore alleging that the two of them were in deals that were frauds against the investors who bought into Trump properties. And yet Donald recently said, oh, if he was in the room, I wouldn't recognize him.
Wow. And speaking of whorehouses, his grandfather had some whorehouses, didn't he?
Yes. Friedrich Trump left a little winemaking town in the Rhine Valley in 1885 when he turned 16 and would have been drafted. They had universal military service then in Germany. He came to America. He took Horace Greeley's advice and went west. And in Seattle, Everett, Washington, and the Yukon Territory, he ran whorehouses. He also built a hotel on land he didn't own, although it wasn't a hotel for sleeping. It was for a little more active usage. And he died when Fred Trump, Donald's father, was 12 or 13 years old. Fred Trump then proved to be a very industrious, hardworking guy. 15 years old, his mother created a business, Elizabeth Christ and Son, and this teenage boy was building garages for these newly popular things called automobiles. He then started one of the first self-service grocery stores, which he sold for a nice profit during the war. He built housing for shipyard workers in Philadelphia and in Virginia. And after the war, he is said to be literally the first person in line at the Federal Housing Administration to get loans so he could build housing for returning GIs, which led later to his being accused and found to have discriminated against everybody who wasn't white.
Mm. And Woody Guthrie wrote a song about that.
He did, and the Guthrie family made it possible for me to have the lyrics of that song in the book. They're pretty powerful.
Yes, they are. We'll play them toward the end of the show. We have a lot to talk about before then. Where did they come up? This also seems to be, and it's a minor part of the book, except that you see it all over television. I found it interesting that his grandfather ran a whorehouse and developed an interest in buxom blondes, and that seems to run through. We got these buxom blondes all over the place.
Yeah. You know, families have traits, and I just pointed out as a curiosity here. But one of the chapters in the book, of course, is called Imaginary Lovers. Donald Trump called up news organizations saying, and this is before everybody knew him like they do now, that he was John Barron or John Miller, and he was a PR man for Donald Trump. And
right.
He planted these stories that Madonna and Kim Basinger and Carla Bruni were beating on his bedroom door, because Donald wants you to know he's not just the modern Midas, he's the modern Don Juan.
Right.
Well, the fact is he had no relationships with any of these women. And it's a man in his mid-40s planting news stories like this. I mean, I think that's one of the most revealing things about his character. So he had the opportunity to straighten this out in terms of these women not sleeping with him on the Howard Stern radio show, where women are just objects. They're not human beings. And that was just a few years ago when Carla Bruni became the First Lady of France. And instead of saying, oh, I didn't do that, that's just... Donald perpetuated the myth. He gave answers that are designed to make people continue to think, oh, yeah, Carla Bruni and I were lovers. And this is just indicative of the, you know, junior high school level emotional nature of Donald Trump.
Hmm. All right, let's move to Trump University. You've heard stories from people, at least I've seen many on television, and you write about so many people who were pretty gullible, who were very hard pressured to sign up for this marvelous course where you're going to learn all about real estate from people who really knew the business, and you were going to make a lot of money as a result of it. And so many people just got so taken advantage of and lost so much money, David.
Yeah, this is a real problem for Donald, no matter whether he gets elected or he doesn't. Donald did a promotional video. It's all about success. I'm going to hand pick each of our faculty, and they're going to be the best of the best, the very best of the best. And we're going to teach you it's all about success. You're going to learn my secrets. Well, who are his faculty? When Donald was asked under oath, he had no idea. He didn't know one of them managed a fast food joint, and two others were in bankruptcy, and a number of them are basically veterans of boiler room high-pressure sales tactics operations. He didn't pick them, as he said. He said, you're going to get a better education than the best business schools. Well, investigators from the state of Texas went to 57 of these seminars, and they said it was useless information, and a lot of it appeared to violate Texas law. And by the way, the law there isn't much different than in other states. People who went to the first seminar for 3 days paid almost $1,500. And at those seminars, the faculty would stand over people's shoulders and tell them how to call banks and get their credit lines increased and open up new credit cards so they could pay $35,000 for the full Donald Trump package where you would get to meet Donald Trump. Mm. Well, of course, if you've exhausted all of your capacity to borrow money by taking out these loans to pay Trump University, right, how could you invest in real estate? You have nothing left. And when the time came to meet Donald Trump, what you got was a picture of you with a cutout of Donald Trump.
David, how many lawsuits are there that are in the courts right now from former students?
Well, I don't know how. Oh, from former students? Well,
right,
there basically are two consolidated class actions in San Diego, and then the New York State Attorney General has another case. And the Donald's testimony in those cases has been released, the transcripts, not the videos. He's fighting release of the videos. But they represent the entire class of people who were duped in this. And this is just a classic bait-and-switch fraud. I mean, the record in this is quite clear. There are a lot of things I might caution about, you know, well, we don't exactly know. This was a flat-out fraud from day one.
Yeah. What is interesting, and it's a common thread in many of these stories that you tell, is somehow the other story with his daughter and her brother, this real estate thing going on in right in the Southern California.
In Mexico.
Yeah. And people are drawn to this because of the big Donald Trump name. Why are so many people drawn and not read the fine print just because Donald Trump is associated with it?
Well, part of it's because, you know, people want to believe what they want to believe, and that's how salesmen and how con artists work. But this one in Baja California is particularly troubling. Donald did a video where he said, I'm the builder, and everybody follows my buildings, and my buildings are great. And you had to pay $5,000 to go hear the presentation. Ivanka, his daughter, his older daughter, came to one of these, and she would say to people, oh, Kathleen, if you buy one, you know, I'm buying one. Maybe I'll drop by and borrow some sugar from you. And the whole thing failed. And it turned out that Donald wasn't the developer, wasn't the builder, had no rights to do hardly anything. He had simply licensed his name. And so when he was asked about this under oath, he said, well, all people had to do was read their mortgage documents. People were told they had 5 minutes to decide to buy or not buy. And I don't know if you've ever bought a house, Kathleen. I've owned a bunch of them as I've moved around the country. And even with all my knowledge of the law, I don't sit there and read the whole thing.
Right.
Who would have found buried deep in the fine print that Donald is only the licensee of his name? He wasn't involved in the building. And Donald did this in other buildings. And in one case in Hawaii, it turned out he could remove his name at any time. He could demand additional payments. And he literally had the option to take his name off the building and build one right next door. And if you bought because Trump would be worth more money than a non-Trump building, that would be devastating for your investment.
And so the whole thing happened and nobody got to borrow sugar from Ivanka, huh?
That's right. Yeah. Exactly right. And this book is, I quote Donald's testimony, his letters, his speeches. This is what Donald has said and done. It's not what I think about Donald. It's
right.
What he did.
Yeah. We're going to welcome phone calls. We're very happy to have David K. Johnston with us. He's usually talking about inequality. I guess he's talking some about inequality this hour as well. He's talking about Donald Trump, and he has followed him carefully, all because he was interested in the start of casinos some 30 years ago. So he met Donald Trump in Atlantic City and has been following his business dealings ever since. And now, of course, his presidential run. The book is The Making of Donald Trump. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize winning investigative journalism who's been at the work for a long time, since he was 18 years old. He has won a Pulitzer Prize for journalism. He's reported for the New York Times and for a number of other prominent publications. He teaches at Syracuse University College of Law, and we're going to take phone calls for him. Our lines are jammed, as I thought they would be, so we'll be with you momentarily here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David K. Johnston, our guest now, 800-486-8655 is our number. Gail in Green Bay is our first caller. Hi, Gail. Gail, are you there? All right, Gail, I don't know where you are. Let's go to Frank in Onalaska. Hi, Frank.
Yes, interesting discussion. I was wondering if the author was familiar with a project that Mr. Trump was developing in New York, specifically a condo hotel project called Trump Soho, where, especially after his bankruptcy in 2004, he was relying on a couple of Russian individuals and Russian money in order to finance this and many other projects around the world. And if that's possibly a reason why his tax returns haven't been released, is because of this linkage to Russian money, clean or otherwise.
Frank, thank you for that question. Yes, I've written recently in my column in the Daily Beast about this case. There is a lawsuit recently unsealed that alleges there was a $250 million tax fraud. And Donald is not a defendant in that case. He is a material witness. He signed a letter that made it possible for the deal to go through. This involved a corrupt Icelandic bank. Remember, the Iceland's economy was sunk
right
temporarily until people disowned the debts. These bankers ran up. Felix Sater, the man we talked about, who's the son of the reputed Russian mob boss and a convicted stock swindler and violent felon, was a partner at the grand opening. Donald and Felix Sater stood together. And why Donald won't release his tax returns is much more complicated than that. Donald didn't pay income taxes in 1978 and 79, as I reported a long time ago. 1984, as I revealed a few weeks ago, 1992 and 1994, he probably hasn't paid income taxes at all since 1978, maybe 1 or 2 years. But in the 1984 matter, and this is discussed at length in my book, there is really strong evidence that Donald has committed tax fraud.
Why doesn't he get called into the carpet for any of this? How can you do this?
Well, if Donald gets called, remember, we almost prosecute almost nobody for tax fraud in this country as a crime. There are about 1,300 cases a year out of 150 million people who file tax returns, and most of those prosecutions are connected to other crimes like drug dealing. So most of these are handled as civil matters because Congress has undone the 1920s law that made tax records public. This would all go on in secret in the background. And Donald is famous for tying everybody up with a great deal of litigation and trouble. So if he's been audited and found to owe money, he has probably negotiated his way out of this by making payments. Okay, I'll pay a penalty, I'll pay the tax, making sure nothing got into the public record.
Hmm. Thank you, Frank, for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. I do want to get to the story of the Polish Brigade building the Trump Tower. He had to knock down the Bonwit Teller department store, and there are several stories here. But talk about treating your workers in a really shabby fashion to say none, and also to make reference to the fact that these were people who were not here legally doing the work, right?
Yeah, so here's Donald Trump, who poses as the champion of the working man. I mean, I'd argue, based on the books I've written, you've had me on, that I've been trying real hard to champion the working man in America and show how they've been badly treated.
Right.
Donald says wages are too high. So in the Bonwit Teller matter, he had to tear down this 12-story building in order to build Trump Tower. And he, instead of hiring an experienced demolition contractor, he hired a window washing firm. The guy brought about 150 to 200 Polish immigrants who were in America illegally and had no work papers. They were paid $4 an hour. A few of them got $5 an hour. They worked 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. Some of them slept on the site. They didn't have safety gloves, goggles, or hard hats. They were taking this 12-story building in the middle of Manhattan down with sledgehammers. And they didn't get paid. Even their measly $4 or $5 an hour, they weren't paid until they threatened to hang Donald's guy off the side of the building. Donald was sued afterwards by a very brave guy who took on the mob-controlled union that was involved in this. You know, non-union and union guys working side by side. That is just how it works. You know, non-union guys show up, the union guys will shut down the site. Not here, because of the mob control. And the judge who heard the extensive testimony in the case found not to be credible Donald's testimony that he didn't know about this. Donald had an office across the street with a picture window view. He went to the site repeatedly. He was photographed repeatedly. And the judge said it was really easy to identify the Polish workers. They were the only people on the site without hard hats.
Oh, goodness. Has he done this to a lot of places? Has he stiffed a lot of people, not paid bills to workers, to companies he owes money to?
Oh, yeah. Donald is notorious for this. I mean, I can't tell you how many people in the past year have come up to me at when I'm doing a TV show or I'm giving a lecture, or a couple times people just stopping me on the street in various cities, and they have these stories to tell. You know, Donald Trump hired me to do this project, and I designed this thing for him, and I went to his office, and he took it all from me and looked at it, and he says, "This is garbage. I'm not going to use it. Get the hell out of my office." And the guy says, "Fine, pay me. You can sue me if you want it." And if it's $25,000, $50,000, even $100,000, and you go to a lawyer, they're going to say, "Are you kidding? The legal fees will be many multiples of the money you owe. Just write it off." And then Donald would use the stuff he refused to pay for. There's a whole bunch of small businesses that went bankrupt or suffered for years because Donald cheated them down in Atlantic City out of their money at the very time that he was also extracting money from his casino company in the bankruptcies by threatening if they didn't give him cash, he would tie them all up in litigation, so they paid him to go away.
So if this is the sum of substance, he's also, well, let's get to the sum of substance in a moment. He's also, he's got this foundation. I'm not sure what the foundation does, but he hasn't given a lot of money to his own foundation, has he?
Right. No, the Donald J. Trump Foundation, which does sort of nondescript giving, you can go to GuideStar.org or Charity Navigator and pull up its tax returns and see who it gave money to, you know, $5,000 here, $10,000 here to various little groups. has been primarily funded by people doing business with Donald, not by Donald. He is the minority contributor, and he's only made one gift in the last 10 years.
Ooh.
The McMahons, who own the actual billionaires who own World Wrestling Federation, the guy who makes his ties in China, they've made donations. And it makes sense. If Donald doesn't pay income taxes, as I'm pretty confident has been the case most, if not all, of the last 30-some years, then a charitable gift is worthless to him, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's no deduction because you have zero income for tax purposes. But if you get your vendors to make these gifts, it's a kind of legal kickback. It's perfectly legal, but it's a kickback, and they fund your charitable operation.
You, let's go back to the theme I was on just a little while ago. In 1990, you write, he feared the word bankruptcy, and if the government had not saved him by taking his side against the bankers, we almost certainly would not be imagining the prospect of Donald Trump living at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. He would have drowned instead in a sea of red ink. What happened surrounding that bankruptcy, and why would the government take his side against the bankers? I don't fully get all of this.
Okay. So Donald Trump has licenses for casinos, and by 1990, he had three casinos. He dominated Atlantic City overwhelmingly. He has borrowed over $3.2 billion, and roughly $900 million of it is personally guaranteed. These bankers didn't check on his other loans, and they had no idea that he had personally guaranteed so much of the money.
Hmm.
So Donald can't pay his bills, and he stops paying his bills, even though he's gone and he tells me I'm worth $3 billion the same day, literally the same day he told somebody else $5 billion. He stops paying many of his bills. And to be a casino owner, you must prove by clear and convincing evidence that you are financially stable, which is defined as you can pay your bills as they come due. So the bankers all get together. Donald is threatening to make all sorts of trouble for him unless they take care of him. And he comes before the New Jersey Casino Control Commission, and the report shows he has a negative net worth of $295 million, and he can't pay his bills.
Hmm.
Well, he should lose his license at that point. But New Jersey has the strongest governor in America. The governor appoints the attorney general, and through the attorney general, the Casino Control Commission is controlled, the Division of Gaming Enforcement, every judge, every prosecutor are controlled. And if you're the governor of New Jersey and you have a major employer with thousands of workers in Atlantic City, and he's trying to get rescued, and on the other side are bankers in New York and Germany and Britain, whose side are you going to take, Kathleen? You're the governor.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Not a hard choice.
Yeah. And tell us the other story. I don't understand what goes on in casinos very well. I may have been to a couple of them, but I haven't done any high roller games.
Good for
this,
you.
Yeah, it's not a good thing to do. This incredible story of this Japanese guy who's throwing down $2 million a game in Trump's, it's at one of his Atlantic City casinos.
Right.
Tell us that story.
Akio Kashiwagi was connected with the Yakuza, the Japanese mafia, and he was a big real estate speculator in Japan when the Japanese real estate market was highly inflated. He busted the casino in Darwin, Australia. They went out of business.
Yeah.
Donald lured him to Atlantic City twice, and I watched him gamble. He played Baccarat, $200,000 every bet, $14 million an hour, and he sat there for almost a week. At $14 million an hour.
Oh.
Now, if the deal was he either doubled his money, he had $6 million of cash, $6 million of credits. Either you go to $24 million or you play till you're broke. Donald was completely freaked out and afraid he'd lose money. And he was pacing the floor at night, and I'm standing there. He's every 30 minutes he demands a phone call. He hires a guy named Jess Markham. Jess Markham, as a teenager, helped invent radar and went on to found the RAND Corporation, the think tank. He's an old man at this point, and to watch the game, because Donald is convinced this guy is cheating him, and Markham is telling him, he's not cheating you, just be patient, and he will lose all the money.
Mm-hmm.
And Donald just doesn't understand the games. He doesn't understand the casino business. And so he mismanages this. I'm watching this, and I figure out there's $500 million of chips that are missing, and all the Trump guys are, no, you're wrong about that. And then one of them wakes up in the morning, because the casino closed for 4 hours every day, and he goes, oh, wait a minute, and he checks, and lo and behold, I was right. There was $500,000 of chips missing, and they tick the guy off, so he leaves. And Donald ends up losing about $6 million on this guy when he had him in the bag,
wow,
because he doesn't know what he's doing.
But he's in the casino business.
Yeah, but just because he has a casino license doesn't mean he knows what he's doing.
Huh.
And when he had really first-rate, competent executives, three of them died in a helicopter crash, and right after they died, Donald, first of all, said, I was supposed to be in that helicopter. Totally false story. Secondly, he then threw them under the bus. Well, my casinos aren't doing well because of these guys. They were good executives who knew what they were doing. He had another first-rate executive working there who later ran Sheldon Adelson's casinos in Macau very successfully. And he got rid of him, and Donald kept promoting yes men. Donald surrounds himself with yes men. If Donald becomes president of the United States, pay very close attention to our senior military officers, because they right now are thinking about, what do we do if this guy orders us to do illegal acts?
Right.
How do we stand up to him? And if Donald starts doing what he's done in the past, he will fire these military officers. He will find those who will do his bidding. And if he decides, well, we should nuke somebody in Europe, which he's talked about doing, we should invade this country because they offended me on Twitter, he'll find people who will do this. And there are always people who will do that. I mean, we have a really good officer corps in the U.S., but, you know, not everybody is totally proper in their conduct.
David K. Johnston, our guest this hour. His latest book is about Donald Trump. There are many stories to be told, and David has been gathering these for 30 years. He's got a lot of lockers filled with papers, Donald Trump papers, The Making of Donald Trump. David is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist, author of many other books, and has joined us many times for really good shows here. So we're welcoming phone calls for him. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David, this comes from an email. I would appreciate any of your insights or views as to what might be defective in the American psyche that allows Donald Trump to become so popular.
Well, there are a couple of things going on here, and that's a really good question to ask. First of all, my peers in the news media have utterly failed to do their job. They have not dug into this guy. And I know some people listening are saying, well, they didn't dig into Obama. Yeah, they did. You can go read. People have found kids he went to kindergarten with in high school, and there are whole books you can read about that. But Donald Barr's news organizations that ask tough questions, the Washington Post, which has done pretty good work on Trump, and has a book of its own coming out shortly, he's barred them. Not TV. So one is, the news media has given Donald all this attention and allowed him to focus people on what he wants them focused on and not on what he's done. Secondly, all these people who are living in economic terror because of the policies in this country that have hurt working people,
yes,
Donald offers a solution. And then thirdly, the Donald has beguiled a big part of the religious community with these claims of Christianity that are just nonsense.
Yeah, he's not a big Bible reader, is he?
Well, Donald says nobody reads the Bible
right.
But Donald Trump. And yet, I show in the book, he's never been able to quote the Bible, and the one thing he tried, he got wrong, and that his policy of revenge, that's just totally anti-Christian. And so I hope that these pastors are not deceiving their flocks. I hope that what's happened is the pastors supporting Donald have been beguiled with his flattery, and they have been deceived, and that they will come to see they have been deceived.
Let's go to Paul in Slinger. Hi, Paul.
Hey, good afternoon. Adding on to this pile of the activities of this amoral dude, go to Bloomberg Business Week, which you can access on Bloomberg.com, the August 1st to the August 7th issue. It talks about Trump's entourage of executives violating the Cuban embargo. And he tries to build, during this embargo period, where nobody could buy cigars or go into Cuba, he's got his legal team and his designers going in exploring topography to build golf courses in Cuba to beat the competition. The article is just stunning of this amoral organism. I don't know where I'm astonished he is where he is.
David.
Well, yes, that's quite a powerful story. And the week before, maybe two or three weeks before, Business Week also reported that 40 Wall Street, a building Donald Trump owns, is the absolute number one preferred location for people the SEC has identified as stock swindlers and con artists, which tells you that they want that address, 40 Wall Street, because if you're running a scam, that sounds really good. And that Donald doesn't vet these people, and he rents to them, and he probably charges them premium rents.
Two of his mottos, and you write about stories that play into these, always get even and hit back harder than you were hit. And he certainly let us know these mottos and acted them out in many of his rallies. Where did those come from? Why is that a big part of who he is, David?
Well, his father is part of this, I suspect, though I'm not totally confident of that. His father was certainly a very tough guy. But more importantly, Roy Cohn, the notorious Roy Cohn, Senator McCarthy's attack dog. Donald wrote in one of his books that one of the things he loved about Roy Cohn, whom he regarded as a second father and a mentor, is Roy would brutalize for you. And what he learned from Roy Cohn is attack, 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 and never spare anything. You know, have basically the psychology of a shark, which is, you know, I don't care about you, I'm going to eat you. And I think that is a fundamental element. Donald has been a bully his whole life. There are stories in Queens that he threw rocks at children in playpens. He, in his own words, says he slugged the second grade teacher because he thought he was incompetent. I'm not sure that story's true. And Donald's father shipped Donald off to a military academy when he was 12 years old because he was getting into so much trouble. And his father felt he needed to be straightened up. I mean, Donald and I are about the same age. I'm a little bit younger than him. Back in the day, Donald's behavior, you would have been told by school counselors, you were maladjusted.
How did he get out of Vietnam?
Well, he had 4 student deferments, which wasn't hard to do, particularly if you were a rich boy. And then he got a medical deferment. He said he had got a doctor's note that he had a bone spur in a foot. He was asked about that sometime in the past year, which foot, and he said he didn't remember. Now, I've interviewed a number of doctors about this, and their opinions vary as to whether you would know which foot if you actually had a bone spur, whether you'd remember at this age. But he got a medical deferment, and then he got a high draft number.
Thanks, Paul, for your call. Michael in Cambria. Hi, Michael.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering what your guest could tell us about the pending lawsuit regarding alleged sexual abuse in New York?
Yeah. Next to nothing. I have not paid attention to that. And as a general rule, I try to deal with matters of real serious substance involving law and economics and whatnot. I mean, I knew about Marla Maples 9 months before she became public, and I only wrote about her twice, and it was when Donald Trump was Bob Guccione of Penthouse Magazine tried to blackmail Donald Trump, and I broke that story. And when Donald didn't report her engagement ring on a government document, and failure to do so could cost him his casino license, and the morning that story broke, Donald went and paid for the engagement ring that he hadn't paid for.
There was this whole
I just don't, other people can go do that stuff. That's not what I'm going to get into.
The New York Post can do that.
Yeah. And there may be a very important story here.
Yeah, there may be.
But you know, I can't do everything. I focus on the things I know,
Thanks, Michael, for the call. Mike in Sheboygan. Hi.
Hi. Well, first of all, you're talking about rationality, and Donald Trump's supporters are not rational. You need to understand the difference between higher thinking skills and response to reptilian fight or flight. Donald represents the Antichrist. That's something any pastor can understand. And to say he's an anti-Christian basically doesn't seem to hit him between the eyes. So I think Donald Trump exposed who he is. His tax cut was for the wealthy corporations. So anybody who's a supporter, who's a middle-income person trying to survive, should realize that Donald's no different than the conservative right-wingers who are always cutting the taxes of the wealthy. So I try to appeal to the people's pocketbook and tell everybody who's a supporter of Donald Trump, if you think Donald's your man, he ain't. And that's really the reality of it, I guess.
David.
Well, I'm not as harsh on the people who are following Donald. I mean, there's an element of people Donald has directly appealed to who are racists and xenophobes. I don't have any quarter for them. But I think an awful lot of people living in these awful economic circumstances, you know, in a number of states, if you get fired for no reason at all, you're not eligible anymore to get unemployment benefits. Mm. There's no welfare. And so a lot, and people are effectively earning less money. You've had me on, and I've told about these every year I do these numbers. Since the Bush tax cuts began, Americans have made $7.5 trillion less money, less income. This isn't taxes, income, than if we had stayed at the level George Bush said we would improve from in 2000. And that's caused enormous pain, and people are trying to figure out what happened to me. And, you know, they don't have the background in education I do and the luxury of, you know, spending 4 or 5 hours a day doing research. So I wouldn't be nearly so harsh on a lot of these people. But there is, of course, the element of people who are racist and xenophobes and homophobes.
Mm-hmm. And the background that he has that most people don't know about, which you mentioned earlier, both his father and Donald, who were not renting to people who were African-American in the many, many tens of thousands of apartments they owned in Brooklyn, right, in New York.
Right.
Those things kind of, yeah.
Donald and his father were absolutely nailed for this. And what did Donald do through Roy Cohn? They sent out in 1972 testers. So a black person or a black couple would go, and they would be economically qualified to rent, thoroughly qualified to rent. And they'd be told, we don't have any units. If that happened, then a white person or couple with the exact same finances would be sent. And they, we have wonderful apartments. Would you like to see this one or this one? And what did Roy Cohn have Donald do and Donald did after this? The government's trying to force welfare people into our buildings. No, they weren't. Had nothing to do with welfare, but that's how Donald spins these things.
Mm-hmm. How do you explain his recent fall from grace, if indeed it's real? And do you think it will last?
Oh, you know, if you and I had done this show the day the Republican convention ended, I still would have said to you there's a good chance Donald will get elected, and this is a big test of how many Americans just below the surface harbor views that they wish the civil rights movement hadn't happened and similar attitudes.
Mm-hmm.
Donald has, being Donald and not knowing anything, you're starting to see other changes. But, you know, Kathleen, there's a long time between now and November. A lot of things can happen. Hillary Clinton can really mess something up. We could have a big terrorist attack. I mean, all sorts of things could happen between now and then. And so I don't know where this election is going, and I'm not in the business of predicting elections.
Yeah. It makes you wonder, though, because there's this other thing when you talk about his getting into the casino business and not knowing anything about it, getting into the real estate thing with the university, and it wasn't a university, and he didn't know anything about that as well, getting into conversations about nuclear weapons and not knowing anything about that, that can you expose that kind of ignorance about the very material that you need to run a country and still win?
Well, you know, we've had presidents who were corrupt. We've had presidents who were idiots. The Republic has survived. You know, Chester Arthur, when he became president, was totally corrupt. And when his buddies came in figuring they were going to get rich, he said, I'm sorry, gentlemen, this is the office of the President of the United States. Get out of here. We've had a murderous racist in the White House, Andrew Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
If Donald Trump is president, we will survive, but we'll go through some terrible crises over this if he is elected. And that's not an endorsement of Hillary Clinton. It's just a description of what will happen. And if you're a senior military officer right now, somebody who would be in the Situation Room, this has got to be for you an absolute nightmare.
Well, they're making their voices known in the last couple of days, too. One more call. Bob in Chippewa Falls. Hi. Bob, go ahead quickly. Oh, Bob, you're not there. Deb, it has to be even quicker. Hi.
Hi there. I was wondering if anything was mentioned in your book about Trump's first failed presidency run when he ran with Oprah Winfrey.
You've mentioned that early in the book, his other runs.
I tell in the book, Donald has been talking about running for president since 1980. He ran on the Reform Party ticket in 1985. In 2000 and said he'd turn a profit. And I go through the history of these things and a lot of other stuff we haven't touched on. I mean, how he destroyed the USFL. And I mean, we've just scratched the surface of what's in the book.
Yeah. David, thank you very much for being with us. I'm really glad you did this work, and I know you're getting some attention for it, and that's a good thing.
Kathleen, thank you for having me on.
Yeah, our pleasure, always. David K. Johnson, it's a book worth reading. David is a fine reporter. He's won a Pulitzer. The book is The Making of Donald Trump. He met him a long time ago, 30 years he's been covering him, when he started in the casino business in Atlantic City. David has worked for all kinds of prestigious newspapers. He is now a columnist for The Daily Beast, The National Memo, USA Today, teaches at Syracuse University's College of Law. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour, and to K.P. as well for on-air production. Here is the aforementioned Woody Guthrie song that was written about Donald Trump's father, Fred.
See, God don't know much about no color line.